Well, first of all, I have to say this about Rwanda. Most of the credit for what they've done belongs to them, because they have the best organized country in Africa. It's smallest geographically and one of the most densely populated. But when I went to Rwanda the first time, 4 years after the genocide, 1998, the per capita income in Rwanda was $268 a year, under a dollar a day. By 2010, when our programs and a lot of other things were in full gear, their per capita income was $1,150 a day. They had quadrupled their income in 12 years. Shows you what you can do if you're really well organized. And since people who do what I did and what you were doing, people who work in the non-governmental movement, we always do better in countries where we can work with both the government and the private sector. In other words, if they have an organized and effective private economy and an organized and effective government, then you can go in and fill in the blanks in a much more powerful way. The process I went through was simple. First of all, let me remind you what happened in Rwanda genocide. It happened in 94, and 10% of the country was killed in 90 days. They killed 800,000 people in 90 days. Most of them were killed out in the bush with machetes. Some were killed by necklacing, having tires put around your neck and set afire. A handful were shot, but most were killed in a national orgy of destruction. And what happened in the White House was this. Probably 20% of those people were already dead before people even started talking about it, for two reasons. One is I was trying to get into Bosnia, and it took me 2 years to convince the Europeans that they had to go help me in Bosnia because America couldn't run Bosnia. Bosnia was part of Europe. We had to have NATO support, and they had to go in. Second, we had already been burned in Somalia. And third, we were just slow on the uptake. And we never even had a meeting on it. My Africa team, who was otherwise fabulous on Africa, they didn't want to talk about it. I think they were afraid I'd go in. But here's what you need to know. If we had just sent a few soldiers there, 4,000 or 5,000, and we got the British and two or three others to go with us, we could at least have saved all the urban lives, with probably zero to minimal casualties. These people were not killing people with AK-47s. They were cutting them to pieces. And so I concluded that it was a terrible mistake. And all I could do was say I was sorry. So fast forward to 2001, I went back when I got out, because I became friends with the president, Paul Kagame, who basically put an end to the violence by coming out of the bush with his army. And a reporter went with our group. We were trying to see what we could do. And he went, and bless his heart, he did what he was supposed to do. He went around determined to find some Rwandan who would say, I wish Bill Clinton would stay the hell out of here because he didn't help us when we were doing this. And he couldn't find anybody to say this. And this is not about me, this is about them. This shows you their character and the impact the president had on them. So he's talking to this cab driver, and he writes a story. And the cab driver said, well, aren't you mad that Bill Clinton's here doing this because America didn't come help you stop the genocide? As a practical matter, I believe we, to come back, could have saved a third of the lives. It happened so fast, and it takes time to deploy and all that. But I think we could have saved a third of the lives, probably. And the cab driver said, no, I'm not mad. I'm glad he's here. We need help. And he said, why aren't you mad? And the guy said, in the first place, he didn't make us kill each other. We did that. And in the second place, he's the only person who ever said he was sorry. He said, you know, the French used to be here. The Belgians were around here. A lot of people had a lot more experience with Rwanda than America did. Nobody else ever said he was sorry. You should remember that today when this is debated. When people tell you they're sorry, you respect them. It is not always a sign of weakness if a country, especially a great country, says, I'm sorry. If you make a mistake and you're trying to do the right thing, sometimes it's a sign of character, not weakness, to say you were wrong. And look, I love the country. The first thing I did was help them finish their genocide memorial. Here are the kinds of things that Rwanda did. First of all, they set aside this genocide memorial. They had no, it was a poor country. They had no embalming services, so people just died out there. And the genocide memorial in Rwanda, outside Kigali on a hillside, is a huge crypt in three layers, which you've seen, right? And in it are the bones of 300,000 people. And their loved ones have come and enrolled them in a roll of honor. And then you've seen the museum where you walk in, and there is this huge, almost like plexiglass cylinder filled with bones as you enter it. And then it's a standard museum. It says, here's how the thing started. Here's what happened when the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi got shot down. Here's what happens. We're going all through this. But I did it. But the Rwandans deserve a lot of credit. And we could all learn a lot from them. The president once said, you know, we're a poor country, and people think poor people can't be trusted, and we're not proud, and we can't grow. So he said, from now on, one Saturday every month, every adult will clean the streets. And that's what they do. And if you go into Kigali tomorrow, you will be shocked at how clean and upbeat the place seems. When I went there the first time, I could tell you Rwanda stories for tomorrow morning, but I'll just tell you these because this is very important. This is about them. I've helped them a lot, but only because they could take help. Hillary and I asked to meet with survivors of the genocide. So they all had great stories. One real handsome guy that had his arm cut off with a machete below his elbow. He claimed he was a one-armed man for peace, laughing about it. A Catholic priest who had risked his life to try to shelter people from the genocide. And the last speaker was this beautiful woman in a bright-colored dress of the lakeside, Lake Country in Africa, who said, and she had no marks on her. Everybody else had been defaced some way except the priest. And she said, you don't see any marks on me because I was cut badly across my back with a machete. And she said, we were betrayed by our next-door neighbor. They were in the Hutu ethnic group. And she said, our children had played together. We had eaten together on every holiday. We thought we were friends. But they were so frightened that when they came to our village, our neighbors gave us up. And they hacked me across the back, and I bled profusely, and they thought I was dead. I awoke in a pool of my own blood to see my husband and six children lying dead around me. And I screamed out to God in anger that I had been spared. And then I realized that I must have been spared for a reason, and it could be nothing as small as vengeance. So I do what I can to help us start again. You know what she did? She organized a foster home and an adoption agency for children of both ethnic groups. Okay, fast forward. I helped them raise $200,000 or $300,000 for this memorial. And they got a little plaque up there and put it in. So they want me to take a tour. So this good-looking Rwandan guy gives me the tour. He was like 25 years old in a beautiful suit. He looked like he was a Hollywood actor. God, he was a good-looking guy. And very articulate. And he's taking me through. And we're talking. I said, did you lose anybody? He said, yeah. My mother, my father, my brother, my sister-in-law. And he said, If you stop at my uncles, aunts, and first cousins, I lost 73 people in my family. And I said, is this hard for you? He said, no, it's therapeutic. He said, the president says we must face what happened so we can let it go. And I said, you know, you remind me of a woman that I met here the first time I was here. And I told him the story of the woman, you know. He gets this incredible smile on his face. He said, I should. She is my aunt. And those six were part of my 73. There's a woman who runs a basket weaving operation in Rwanda who lost 7 of her 10 children. The 3 oldest were boys who were in the military and they were away. And her husband. So she's a 50-year-old widow with 7 dead kids. And she has to start again. So she goes and finds a woman from the other ethnic group who, like her, was good at basket weaving. And they start weaving baskets. Pretty soon, other women start showing up without regard to their ethnic group, and they need help. So she trains them to weave baskets. Pretty soon, they're not selling them on the roadside. They're selling them in stores in Kigali. Pretty soon, they're in Macy's in New York City. Pretty soon, young men come up and say, teach us how to do this. We need some way to make a living. So about 4 years into this project, this 26-year-old guy that had been there a year came to see this woman, asked her if he could see her. She said, yes. He said, you have been wonderful to me, and I cannot live with myself any longer. I murdered one of your children. And he said, I know you have older sons who are in the military, and you should send for one of them to come and kill me. It is just, and I will work for you every day until he comes. And she looked at him and said, what good would that do? I forgive you. Get up and go back to work. Think you could do that? So, yes, I helped Rwanda. And, yes, I apologize. They made it easy because they did the only thing you can do in the face of inexplicable madness. They wanted the people that ordered it, tried before an international criminal tribunal. Everybody else, and I mean everybody else, goes back to their local village, faces a village council, and gets some version of a community duty for up to 3 years. And everybody tells the truth about what happens, and then they let it go. We could all learn something from them.